Radio, CIUT 89.5, the sound of your city.
And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. Phil Conlon is here.
Good afternoon, Phil.
So today we're going to talk to Stephen Gowans. Stephen has written an article about the demise of Robert Mugabe, one of the great figures in African history in the liberation struggle, and much maligned in our press, but not so in Africa. Difference of opinion. So we're going to be getting into that. It's important. In the latter part of the show, Phil and I will be discussing some of these developments, particularly the one in Hong Kong, where now you have to have an American flag and sing the national anthem of the in order to prove that you really want democracy for Hong Kong. It's quite amusing. But I believe we're joined by Stephen Gowans. Are you there, Stephen?
I'm here, Phil. How are you?
Very good, and it's good to be talking to you. You've written an article. You're at gowans.wordpress.com, is it now at gowansblog.com?
Yes, the latter.
The latter.
Yes, okay. That way you avoid looking at advertising.
Yeah. Actually, the beauty of this stuff is that now you just write Stephen Gowans and you got it. But your article is Robert Mugabe, the National Liberation Hero, who was demonized for trying to make liberation meaningful. A very good article, very important one in my opinion, particularly since I also just now read Oakland Ross in a Toronto Star who said, what we need to know about Robert Mugabe is he didn't listen well to others. And then he thought he had really said something smart. Okay, why did they demonize Robert Mugabe?
Well, you know, I have this hypothesis about why anyone's demonized any leader. I mean, leaders of governments or movements which reject the idea that Western investors and corporations should have unfettered access to their country's mineral resources and land and labor and markets, and who try to redress any kinds of difficulties in or imbalances in the distribution of land, they'll be reviled by Western corporate-owned media and opposed by Western corporate-dominated governments. By contrast, leaders who accept the domination of their country's economy by Western firms and investors, when they might be expected to do otherwise, will be celebrated and lionized. Mm-hmm. And we have a naturally occurring experiment to test this hypothesis, and that is, you know, there were two national liberation movements in southern Africa, or at least two that I can talk about here. Mm-hmm. One in apartheid South Africa, the other in apartheid Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. Mm-hmm. And both liberation movements had the same goals. I mean, universal suffrage, nationalization of mineral resources, and land redistribution. So one was led by Nelson Mandela, the other by Robert Mugabe. Mandela pursued and achieved the first goal, universal suffrage, but he didn't pursue the other two. Robert Mugabe pursued and achieved all three of the national liberation movement's goals. So he achieved universal suffrage, he began to indigenize mineral resources, and he undertook a fast-track land distribution program. That is, a program of land distribution that would be achieved now rather than three centuries from now. So according to my hypothesis, Nelson Mandela should be celebrated and adored in the West because he didn't carry through on every plank of the National Liberation Program, and Robert Mugabe should be execrated and demonized, and that's exactly what's happened. And it seems the degree to which a national liberation leader is demonized in the West is proportional to the degree to which the leader has presided over a movement that's faithfully pursued its goals.
Mm-hmm. You know, I thought that is, to me, the core of your article and the one that argument and people need to think about it. It's this matter of, and the two of them, how they related to each other, actually. I can recall when I happened to be in Tanzania at the time, and there was a, the West was leading a demonization campaign about it's time for Robert to go, and they were talking to African leaders, and there was a meeting called in Dar es Salaam, I believe, and Mr. Mbeki came from South Africa, and the leader of Tanzania was there, and the leaders of Kenya, etc. And they went into a closed-door meeting with Mugabe, and the prediction was that he was going to be escorted out of the door, and then also he would say goodbye, and etc. However, when they came out, they were on holding on to his arms on either side and reminding everybody he's one of the fathers of modern Africa. And Western media went home pretty unhappy. He was, I noticed from being in Tanzania, that he was as popular easily as Nelson Mandela for exactly the reason you mentioned. Everybody in that region talks about the land and who has it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he was celebrated in Africa. And he's still celebrated in Africa, I mean, in South Africa as well. I mean, we have the parties.
Well, they have a land question, do they not? I mean, and my understanding is that they actually get rather heated about this because he did the remarkable thing of taking the step. He didn't do it immediately. Could you talk about that? They liked him. Margaret Thatcher and others were very nice to him. But he had promised that they were going to do something on the land issue. And Britain, by the way, said, oh, yeah, we think that's a good idea. We'll even pay for it. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, he was celebrated in the West initially. I mean, land redistribution was a principal goal of the National Liberation Movement. And the arrangement that was made initially after this guerrilla struggle and finally a negotiation which led to, the establishment of universal suffrage and the creation of Zimbabwe. Mm-hmm. This idea that the land would be redistributed, so the program, the National Liberation Program, would be achieved, but there would be help in undertaking that program. Specifically, yeah, there would be money provided by the UK, because the black majority had been denied access to the land and the means of production and certainly didn't have the money to pay out these white, or the descendants of white settlers. So the UK agreed to provide the money, but this would be on a so-called willing seller, willing buyer basis, which in a way is almost ensured that land redistribution would proceed at a very glacial pace, because you didn't have to sell the land if you owned it. I mean, you could sell it at whatever point, and when you were prepared to sell it, then the British government would pick up the tab. But the British government reneged on that. Under the Blair government, actually.
It was Blair, and he reneged on payment.
Yeah.
Not going to do it.
We're not going to do it.
Until some other things are done that they would like.
And so Mugabe said, well, we can't pay these farmers, we can't compensate them, so we'll take the land. This is land that had been stolen from us.
Mm-hmm.
And we require restitution, and the only way in which we can recover that land is to take it, which he did. Now, by contrast, I mean, South Africa still follows this kind of willing seller, willing buyer model, but land reform in South Africa has proceeded at a very glacial pace.
Yeah, and by the way, that's one of the unreported stories, because when I was in Tanzania, I did meet South Africans who told me harrowing stories about, there's a lot of violence amongst the farmers, they're armed, they often kill people, on this question of when is land going to be reformed. And here, you can hear, there is no reports of this, and certainly it's the whole idea is treated as though it's a complete mistake, on the assumption that only white people know how to grow crops, I think. Isn't that what it is? I mean, at the end of the day, they have the know-how, and the other guys are something else.
Yeah, I mean, that's the idea. And also, the whole idea of land redistribution, especially without compensation, is considered to be an affront to the principle of private property, you know. And you certainly can't tolerate that. As is the idea of nationalizing, for example, the mineral resources. Even in the Zimbabwean case, although Mugabe was demonized for want to indigenize mineral resources, his program was actually rather mild. It wasn't the state was going to completely nationalize or expropriate the private owners of mines. It was that Zimbabweans or black indigenous Zimbabweans had to have a majority stake in the mining companies. It's quite a mild requirement.
Well, they also found a way to hem them in. Actually, I don't know where that is now, but I can recall when they were using the term blood diamonds to indicate that you know they shouldn't really be handling or selling Zimbabwe's diamonds. What is the status? Would you know the diamond business in Zimbabwe today?
No, I haven't kept up to date on it. But there is certainly, you know, this idea that who owns the diamonds? Who owns the mineral resources? Well, the West owns or ought to own, which was certainly something that irritated Mugabe, this whole notion that Zimbabweans don't own their own resources and can't derive the benefit of their sale.
Mm-hmm. The foundation of his status seems to really actually turn now on the land question. I noticed that the president, in his remarks, the new president of Zimbabwe, he said, by addressing the land question and nationalizing it, and made Zimbabwe truly a sovereign country. This was the accomplishment. And, you know, I think for all the negative articles I've read, they tiptoe around that in terms of, was that a popular move or not? It seems to have been really popular. So that no matter what you think of, you know, personal quirks or traits, you kind of come back to he did it.
Yes, popular. For who? It certainly wasn't popular among the white minority, but it was popular among the black majority. Mugabe called this program a democratization of land ownership, which it certainly was. It certainly wasn't a popular program in the West, where it was completely reviled.
Mm-hmm. And you did raise, and I think it's, again, the name Mandela, it has to come up, but... He departed the scene without the land issue being addressed. Well, if it was addressed, it was postponed. And there's no question that South African society is rankled by this, a lot of bad feelings, and that this, you know, it really is kind of the test of national liberation leaders. You know, you referred to the fact that, I mean, this is a kind of a necessary step if you're going to liberate your country. We have Fidel Castro. He was, well, the main label on Fidel when he came on the scene was land reform, and he did it. And there was, of course, the Mexican leader who said, we're tired of Americans controlling our oil. We're going to take over the oil. And those are extremely popular moves, but it also it defined what it meant to, you know, achieve true independence and a chance to develop your own country in whatever way you might choose to go.
Yeah, there are some national liberation leaders who have stopped that political sovereignty. But the argument can be made that you don't achieve true sovereignty unless you have economic sovereignty, unless you have control over your economy.
Mm-hmm.
And you could read articles in 2011, 2013, well, going back some time, however, when Mandela was still around, just when, actually, by the time Mandela died, in the Financial Times, in the Globe and Mail, talking about why Mandela ought to be celebrated. And the argument was, he ought to be celebrated because, you know what he did? He achieved the, or he pursued the national interest by abandoning the National Liberation Movement's goals. And that's why he ought to be celebrated. He didn't nationalize mineral resources. He didn't undertake a fast-track land redistribution program. And this is something that should be celebrated, they argued. And then they contrasted that with Mugabe and said, look at Mugabe, he's driving his country into ruin through his land redistribution programs and trying to nationalize his mineral resources. But it's quite clear that, that Mugabe was pursuing a program that was at odds with the interests of corporate America and you know, the corporate community in the West.
Yeah. We're speaking to Stephen Gowans, and he has a new article about all this. Robert Mugabe, the National Liberation Hero, who was demonized for trying to make liberation meaningful. I guess, by the way, you're saying he did make it meaningful. Not only did he try, he actually did, and he is beloved for that, and it's very interesting. There's going to be a big funeral, and the state is all out for this, and they're inviting the family. There was problems with his family, but they're showing a lot of respect for his Robert Mugabe's family. And there's going to be a lot of people, from leaders from all over Africa and around the world. I want to mention that I noticed that China today was prominent in saying that this, that the illegal sanctions against Zimbabwe should come to an end, and they should come to an end now. And they say that in saying that, China says they are endorsing the position of the Southern African Development Community, and there, which is going to have a day of solidarity on October the 25th with Zimbabwe. And so talk about sanctions. Do they have any effect on this, the economic problems of the country?
You know, looking back at Mugabe's career, especially over the period in which he was demonized, it struck me that the program that the West had undertaken to overthrow him, and they were clear that that was what they were trying to do, is, but for the details, exactly the same as the program that's being used to try to overthrow Maduro. It's exactly the same program, and it's undertaken for exactly the same reason. And yes,
Maduro, Venezuela, yes.
Yeah. Same reason. Same program.
Same sanctions.
Sanctions. Yeah, I mean, there were sanctions. The sanctions were intended to asphyxiate the economy, which they did. The sanctions were intended to put pressure on the Zimbabwean population to seek to overthrow its government. And they also had other programs as well. I mean, there was the United States directing the opposition to coalesce under one leader and under a party that had to have the name Democracy in it. Called the Movement for Democratic Change.
Yes.
Also, the United States and other Western governments providing funding to an extra parliamentary movement that was to take to the streets to put pressure on the government to try and overthrow it. We also had the same game they play in Venezuela of contesting elections that aren't even held or declaring that they're fraudulent before they're even held.
Yeah. Yes, and by the way, again, there have been elections from the beginning. There has been an opposition, and you're quite right. I remember they built up these individuals, and they would host them, and they would be seen with Blair, and they'd be seen with Clinton, and the anointed ones, and well, they didn't do so well. And it was very clear that if you were to analyze the election the way you would in, say, Canada, you would notice where the loyalty is, where the support for Mugabe was, and where the opposition was. The opposition didn't have a majority, never succeeded.
No, and the opposition parties are being run out of the United States and out of the UK in the same way that the opposition in...
No wonder they fail.
Pardon? Yeah, in the same way the opposition's being in Venezuela is being run out of Washington and Canada. It's the same thing. And they played this game of heads I win, tails you lose. So we declare your election as fraudulent, and if we win it, well, then it was all right. But if our guy loses, well, then it was fraudulent. And so then we undermine the legitimacy of the government. And then that's where we get this myth about Robert Mugabe was a thug and a dictator.
Mm-hmm.
Any of the restrictions that were imposed.
He briefly shared power, actually. He allowed, I recall, the opposition man, whose name won't come to me, to be in office. And one of the problems the West found with Mr. Tsvangirai was that he also said, well, taking the land was a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of, you know, they had a script, but even they sort of said, oh, let him say it, you know. Because he didn't have a chance if he didn't acknowledge that. But he managed to talk himself out of government. But they actually, for a period of time, under maximum pressure, people got to remember this was the period of the heyday of the one world order under Bush and Clinton and all that. And you know, there was nobody. Yeltsin was asleep in Moscow, and there was just really nothing in the way of the empire. But they still couldn't push over Mr. Mugabe. He refused to give up.
He did. He did. And you know what restrictions on civil and political liberties he did impose were completely justifiable, given that it was quite apparent, and it was almost acknowledged, that a foreign government was interfering in the affairs of Zimbabwe, was trying to subvert its constitutional order to overthrow an elected president.
Mm-hmm.
In order to reverse the land redistribution program, and they were pretty clear about that as well.
Mm-hmm.
That was the intention.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Stephen Gowans, gowansblog.com. And apropos of some of these problems, I was also reading today that the Chinese ambassador to Zimbabwe said to the people of Zimbabwe, he said, we noticed that... an act was written in the United States Congress called the Democracy and Economic Recovery Act in 2001,
uh-huh.
Aimed at changing the government of Zimbabwe. He says, we now have an act called the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act that's in front of the United States Congress. He said, we have a lot in common.
Same kind of overthrow.
Yeah, the U.S. government, Congress is going to take care of all the Democracy and Economic Recovery Act. I bet that was a great plan for Zimbabwe. Well, basically, that was the sanctions plan, right?
It was. It was the sanctions plan. Essentially, it blocked Zimbabwe from accessing credit institutions. But you know, the effect of these sanctions campaigns are that they deter anyone from dealing with the government because they're afraid of what's going to happen to them if they do.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes almost like a total embargo. And it does have very baneful effect on the economy and on the lives of ordinary people,
mm-hmm.
which is, although it's not the stated intention, it still is, I think, a recognized effect.
Yeah. This has to be seen. Actually, what I'm reading here, the Southern African Development Community, the fact that they would go on record right now saying end the sanctions, and when we put that against the parallel stories of Nelson Mandela and Robert Mugabe, it would appear that the Mugabe intransigence and, you call it vision, might be now prevailing in a new... We do have a new world order, not the one that Bush thought we were going to have. We do seem to have a new world order where there are countries that will come and do business with you, even if America tells them that's naughty.
Mm-hmm. China in particular.
Yeah. So these signs, in terms of historical trends, and I know you this is Stephen Gowans, and he's interested in historical trends. It looks kind of like on the upbeat, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, there are certain countries that have been very determined and resolute to meeting goals of essentially egalitarian goals, and Zimbabwe is one of them. One of the things that had always disappointed me, though, is that the Western left often regarded Mugabe as some kind of reactionary and dictator and tyrant, and often didn't have much time for him. And I don't think they do even today.
Absolutely.
And yet, you know, I used to follow Mugabe, used to go to the General Assembly of the UN every year and give a speech. And his speeches were ones that should have appealed to anyone on the left. I mean, he was always, well, first of all, he always made plain that what is the goal of a president of any country or a leader of any country is to represent the interests of the people within his or her country. And yet, he complained that the United States and its allies have often tried to pressure countries to ignore the interests of the people they represent and instead to accommodate the interests of Western corporations. He also expressed solidarity year after year with, you know, the Palestinian struggle, with Venezuela,
yes,
with Iran, and so on,
yes,
progressive movement.
Mm-hmm. But something I recall, too, and I'm glad you mentioned that, his speeches at the UN were remarkable. They were always clear, and he was truly, his view was with the people of the world, and he saw imperialism, colonialism as the problem, and it has not gone away. But he also, he made it a point usually to speak, and often outdoors in Harlem. People, I think when you, I take your point, by the way, the left is loves to show off its bankruptcy on these things, but black Americans always appreciated him. He used to take time to talk about Pan-Africanism and the problems of oppression of Africans.
Uh-huh.
Something that was noted, and I don't think has been forgotten. You know, I don't know if you've given much thought to this, but one remarkable moment that in his career late was the decision to send Zimbabwean troops at the request of the government of Congo. President Kabila was being attacked by his neighbors, Uganda and Rwanda, by the way, both of whom denied they were attacking him. But they were. They had troops actually just outside Kinshasa. And Zimbabwe and Angola and Namibia said, hey, and they took a stand. And he said that was an extension of his principles, that, of course, that you couldn't tolerate that countries would invade a fellow African country without any authorization at all, and particularly lying while they're doing it, with the goal of removing the president of Congo, Kabila.
Uh-huh.
That was a very brave move, and he succeeded. They actually defeated Uganda and Rwanda.
Yes, and that was probably one of the key reasons why the West execrated and vilified him. That was one reason. The other was his rejection of the neoliberal structural adjustment program that had been imposed on Zimbabwe.
Yes, and I always hated the acronym turns into SAP.
Yes.
You know, I assumed that, you know, some smart aleck in CIA wrote that.
Yeah. And then the third was the land redistribution program.
Which, by the way, came after. I mean, he made that decision, all right, let's finish this land issue, after that defense of Congo.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really, maybe he at that point said, all right, I've had it with these people. it'd be very interesting to know what the dynamic was, because they did wait a number of years, and there were people who said, oh, he's not going to do it. They're, you know, they're going to play it smart. They're going to get along with Thatcher and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But the meeting, the discussion, I'd love to have read the discussions inside ZANU, that party, when they said, all right, we promised, and the British promised, and they broke their promise, and now we have the land issue, so let's have a vote. That must have been a great moment.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, Stephen, I touched on the Hong Kong thing. Do you mind me asking, what do you think of the Hong Kong demonstrators having such beautiful printed signs and American flags? And I bet you don't know the words of the American the national anthem, but they can sing the entire national anthem. And they say that, please, Trump, liberate us. What do you make of that? They're not asking you to help, by the way. They want Trump.
Yeah, well, you can probably infer what their goals are.
And the U.S. says they're not involved. That's actually calling for an attack on the government of China. It's calling for the Marines, basically, not that they'd be any help in the situation.
It is, and the article I read about this morning in the newspaper tried to diminish the significance of it by suggesting that these people weren't inspired by U.S. values, but they were simply seeking U.S. support, which I think they were doing both.
Singing the national anthem might suggest they're inspired. I don't know.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. It's just a remarkable moment, I'm really glad we're remembering Robert Mugabe. I think we should. Here's a guy who, really, his career ought to be looked at, and you've done great, made a contribution toward it. Just based on our conversation, there's a lot to be learned there, and all those moments should be revisited. In my opinion, I hope that I assume that we'll get good writing out of Africa. Following your suggestion, we probably won't get much out of in the West, but it's one way I'll really be studying.
Yeah.
Well, Stephen, it's nice talking to you. We appreciate the article, and I'm learning to say gowansblog.com.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay.
We'll see you soon. Bye-bye. We have some music, I think, from Zimbabwe. We're going to play that. The Zimbabwean national anthem seems appropriate. There will be leaders in great numbers attending the funeral of Robert Mugabe. I think it's scheduled for the 14th of September. This is the Taylor Report. We're on SoundCloud, Taylor-Report, and we're on Facebook, The Taylor Report, according to last time I heard. Gowans is now gowansblog.com. But of course, you just put the name in the machine and it comes up anyhow.